First off, thank you all for listening to our content today. Thank you all for tuning in to the Juneteenth programming here on The Numbers and X-Ray. I am joined today by Ella Ray, Community Partnerships Coordinator over at the Portland Art Museum. Hello, Ella.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Today, we're going to be discussing Black art and its reemergence in pop culture. But before we jump into the meat of discussion, please, for those that haven't had the pleasure of meeting you,
hello.
Introduce yourself. Like, tell us who you are. Tell us what you got going on.
Yeah. So, again, I'm Ella Ray. I'm currently the Community Partnerships Coordinator at the Portland Art Museum here in Portland, Oregon. So essentially, I do the work along with a large learning and community partnerships team of coalescing and collaborating with individuals in the Portland community who are already doing the work, acknowledging that there are individuals who work outside of museum structures who do amazing things and who really are the backbone of our community, particularly using creative means. There's a lot of very creative people in Portland, and my passion is redistributing the museum's resources to encourage that work to continue and encourage structures like the museum to collaborate and acknowledge the labor that particularly Black and brown people are doing.
Right.
So that's what I do. I'm from Oregon.
Hey, now.
I've lived here my whole life. been thinking about art probably my whole life. I'm pretty sure I was talking about art before I knew I was talking about art.
Wow.
And I come from a very creative family, and I feel very lucky to get to do this work and get paid for it.
Hello.
Hey.
So you mentioned, you know, trying to bridge the gap between creatives outside of the current structure and mm-hmm. the existing structure. What are some of the tools and mechanisms that you found useful in pulling in those creatives? Because I can imagine that some of them are existing outside of the current structure because they feel as though either that that structure isn't welcoming to them, or, you know, from an artist standpoint, they just want to be avant to it. Just, I don't want to be in, you know.
Totally. And, like, an aside is I completely respect individuals who want to create and exist outside of dominant paradigms, who want to do their practice without acknowledging museum structures. I think that's really exciting, and I would never want to force anybody into a collaboration. But I think we've had a lot of luck in allowing for creatives who maybe, and artists and social practitioners and all the people, allowing them to give us feedback, to voice their concerns about the museum, to ask for more from us and ask us to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And once we start doing that, the museum has slowly started to chip away some of our barriers. And I'm not going to say that it's perfect, but I think in a lot of ways, our tactics are listening, not to respond, but listening because we have to.
Right.
The world is increasingly changing, probably, as you know, and the museum structure is outdated. Like, I will say that. And I think a lot of the folks I work with would stand by that. And we are trying to figure out, how do you reconfigure a space that initially was unwelcoming and maybe continues to be?
Mm.
And truly allowing artists to express that has been a great starting point for us, because we can imagine an otherwise and maybe make that otherwise real.
Right.
And maybe the museum's a part of that.
Right.
And that's my goal, is that the museum is a part of that in some way. I don't know which way yet, but
what would you say are some of the benefits to artists working with the museum? Some of the things that you have in mind with regards to bringing them into the fold.
Are you asking in the sense that the benefits that the artists gain from?
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately, sure. I think everyone understands, sure, if I get an exhibition, people find out about me. But I'm sure there's a lot more than just that, you know, as far as forming a relationship with the museum, gaining access to whatever other partners or other artists they may be involved with that could impact that, you know, that artist themselves.
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head on a lot of the kind of major bullet points of how a museum relationship can be beneficial. I won't say that it always is beneficial, but it is in a lot of ways. Network building is a lot of how contemporary art happens, whether people like it or not. And like I'd said before, or maybe I didn't say it yet, but like resource redistribution is something that I think about incessantly. And how do we as museum people give up our power and our access for people who need it? Like, instead of speaking for people, let's pass the mic.
Okay.
So in a lot of ways, it's giving space, like physical, tangible space to artists. Maybe it's their first time ever showing in a museum. And that means something, whether it's writing them a check to support their materials, whether it's connecting them with other artists who they maybe have never been grouped together with.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I had said earlier, the museum structure is problematic and we're trying to change those things, there are benefits to collaborating with an institution that has those resources and has the time and energy to truly support people. And I hope that's what we're doing. I think that's what we're doing. But yeah, I hope that answers that.
No, it definitely answers it. I feel as though, you know, based on some of the conversations we've had, you know, prior to this one, that you're truly dedicated to that. You know what I'm saying? You bring a very easygoing, attainable sense to those conversations because I am not an art head. Let me just go on the record, ladies and gentlemen. I do not have collections of art in the house. But I guess, you know what? Let's dial that back.
Okay.
Because there are pieces that I've purchased.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, because I don't have a gallery set up in the house, I don't have a dedicated space, you know, for the most part, you know, we're getting frames from Amazon and and we're hanging our, you know, putting it in poster frames and we're putting the art up. There's still, you know, there's still something about creating that space in the house, creating that atmosphere, that feel.
Absolutely. I really discourage particularly Black folks from being like, oh, I don't know about curation, or I don't know about art, or I don't really know how these things go together. And I'm like, yes, you do. Mm. Yes, you do.
Right.
I truly believe that we know it. And I don't know how to describe that we know it, but I once read, I can't remember, I think it's a bell hooks essay where she talks about how particularly Black women who are the keepers of the culture in a lot of ways, how their photo albums are our first instance of curatorial endeavors.
Gosh.
How, you know what I'm talking about. So think about like any auntie, any grandma, anybody, and it doesn't have to be gendered, and I'd like to break those gendered ties, but think about when you sit on a couch with your grandmother and you look at that photo album. There's a reason that those pictures are next to each other. That is inherent to the way we operate in a lot of ways. That is curatorial practice.
That's amazing.
These ideas are not my own. We'll make an end note about what that essay is.
Right.
But
right.
Purchasing art, you don't need to have a degree to invest in those things. And even images that you find on Google or Tumblr or any of those image circulation websites, when you put them on your Instagram and you choose where they go next to each other, that's curation.
We have to have we're gonna delve more into that. But yes, photo albums, dude. My mom has, it's so funny. She's got separate photo albums, you know, for each of the kids, for each of us. This is, you know, document this part of my life from this age, from birth to this age. Then my brother's photo album's over there, and there's a wedding photo album. And you're right, like, there's notes on these photos.
Absolutely.
These things are put in a specific order. This is when we went to this trip. And I never thought about that as curation.
Yeah.
Never thought about it. I think we need to have a workshop or something where we're just discussing what curation looks like and has been for African Americans.
Totally.
So we feel a lot more comfortable using the term. We feel... And not that we need to add a greater sense of purpose to what we're doing, but I think it definitely adds more weight to it.
Yeah.
When you think about, you know, what you're presenting.
Yeah. And I like you said, we don't need to make those photo albums academic in any way to make them important. They're already important. Yes. They already matter to me. I've already started to hang on to photos in a way that's nearly obsessive, and place them next to each other and write notes on the back because that's important. And that's a part of visibility, seeing ourselves through time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a larger curatorial conversation is always needed because I think often people from the African diaspora, Black people, feel like they can't use certain words when it comes to art.
Mm, yeah.
Black people aren't even often described as artists. We dance around terms. And while some of that may be a purposeful avoidment or avoidance, excuse me, of like white supremacist terms, historical terms that we no longer relate to.
Right.
But like, do we acknowledge how many Black artists are living in our communities around us, who are our friends? Like,
we don't.
And even I'm guilty of that as well. So I think, yeah, it's a really complicated and exciting moment in time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it's really exciting. What would that look like? Would that need to be a section of the museum's program, any museum's programming?
Sure.
Like, what would be the most accessible way that you think that could happen? Would it be something that needs to happen in the community center? You know, maybe a place of worship, you know, on an off night. Like, what type of institutions and how could we get the ball rolling on something like that? Just conversations around art.
That's a really good question. And I think I struggle with that. Like, where does this begin?
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in art history classes in college, we needed that conversation. So does it begin in school? I don't know, because then also my college classes, I'm a privileged individual to have gone to a 4-year institution and take classes about art history. Right. I studied contemporary art history and critical theory. Right. So that is, most individuals do not have access to those courses. So while I want to say it starts with investing in professors and teachers and educators who can, you know, peel some of the layers back and acknowledge things like photo albums and acknowledge things like quilting and storytelling and the spoken word aspect of Black life.
Mm.
I don't want to go so academic.
Right.
Because there's issues with colleges as an institution.
Yes.
So
yes.
I don't know where it begins, because I also think it needs the monetary support from large institutions.
Mm.
But do I want those large institutions to be involved? I don't know, because I believe folks from the community can teach these workshops.
Of course.
And
of course.
Should.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's this weird holding two things of, yeah, in an ideal world, it just starts happening, but I don't know where, so I can't answer your question.
That's good. No, that's fine. It's fine. I mean, if you had the answer right now, I'm pretty sure we'd have some initiatives in place.
Ooh.
We'd start moving towards it already. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
We'd be working on it.
Exactly. So this is good. Everyone listen, let's work on it. Let's make this part of our collective conversation.
Let's talk about it.
Because we're definitely going to follow back on this.
Yes.
We have to. All right. So let's talk about your journey through art. Like, how did you get here? So you are an Oregon native. Where exactly?
So I was born in Eugene, Oregon. I lived there until I moved to Portland for college.
Okay.
Okay.
So in Eugene, did the art bug bite you then? Was there, you know, were you creating art at some point? Like, how exactly did everything come together?
I don't want to say blame, but I would blame my parents. So my dad's from the Bay Area, and also partially Los Angeles as well. And my mother lived in Los Angeles, and they lived there until basically the moment I was born. And they had their hands in everything, and then magically had some children and didn't stop having their hands in everything. So I grew up in a wildly creative house where music was incessantly playing.
Nice.
My dad's a record collector. So it started with sound. Like, all of my fondest and creative memories have a soundtrack. which I feel very lucky for. My mother is ceramicist, thought leader, like writer, can do makeup, can do hair, she can do all the things. And I grew up in a household where I was never discouraged from a creative path, which is really lucky.
Yeah. Very.
I didn't have parents pushing college. Also, they never went to college, so I don't think they knew how to push college. They were getting by in a lot of ways, and they just happened to be really creative, too. And I believe that all people are creative, but they just wore it in a way that I didn't have a choice. I grew up just collaging, and my parents had 35mm cameras, so I started thinking about film at a really young age, and then I was a really early reader, so I started thinking about literature. And then just as school progressed, I started realizing that you can learn about art in school. I always saw art as separate from school. Going to particularly low-income public schools without a lot of arts education, it wasn't until high school that I had a teacher who taught me about art history. And I was like, wait, you can learn about history through images and objects? This is what I've been wanting to do my whole life.
Wow.
And yeah, it was like this. And I grew up on the internet, to be honest. Like, I am of an age where I started following blogs and Tumblrs and watching YouTube about art at a very young age, because there was very little censorship on the internet. Like, my parents weren't my parents weren't blocking sites. They weren't being like, oh, you can't go on X, Y, and Z.
Right.
So I was trying to find creativity anywhere. And the internet was a huge part of that for me, because Eugene is a fairly white place.
Okay.
And I,
for those who don't know,
it's a predominantly white town. It's pretty like, yeah, we can get into that later.
Right.
Yeah, I started looking for other black and brown people who were being creative. And as much as they probably existed in Eugene, I was so young that I thought it existed everywhere else. I wasn't ready to look around me.
Got you.
So it was kind of complicated, but then I decided to go to college and chose art history. And now I'm here.
What? How was the culture shock from Eugene to Portland?
It was a culture shock, and it wasn't. It was a culture shock in the sense of it was my first time living away from the people who had raised me. But as far as being with black people, I was lucky enough to have parents who were like, yeah, you're going to hang out with black people. Yeah, you're going to be around your aunts and uncles. You're going to be around your cousins. Like, you need that to survive. Because outside of our household was very white. And at some points, very dangerous to be a not white person.
Right.
So it was a culture shock, and it wasn't. I just found it to be a culture shock in that there were things to do. I was like, what? Things are open past 8:30? Yeah. No shade on Eugene, though. Like, thank you for what you gave me when I was there.
Right.
And thank you to the black folks who are still there, you know, who are making it work in a place like Eugene. I love that. But yeah, it was amazing to be able to go to galleries.
Yeah.
And go to, like, last Thursday.
Was your first gallery experience here in Portland, or what?
Yeah, okay. In the sense that it was like, I was old enough to know that it was a gallery.
Okay.
I was old enough to go by myself. My mom had taken me to the University of Oregon Museum as a baby. I still remember the show that we saw. I was probably like 4 or 5, and we saw an Andy Warhol show.
Oh, nice.
And there was this giant, giant painting of glittery shoes, and my mom said I stood there forever.
Are you serious?
And I was just like engulfed, which is really funny because I do love shoes and I love art. My relationship with Andy Warhol is, you know, on rocky ground sometimes.
Okay.
But
okay.
Yeah, I think Portland was what kicked me into galleries and museums and connecting and the network that I now have, who my friends are artists, my friends are writers, my friends are not artists and not writers, but I still consider them to be artists and writers.
What artists are you most excited about today?
Ooh, okay. Oh my gosh, this is a hard question.
Is it?
It is a hard question.
You don't have to do a top five.
I do or I don't?
You don't.
Okay.
And it's not in order of importance either. So you can just name artists you're excited about.
Okay. There's a painter. Her name is Teresa, or I think it's Teresa Cromati. Please correct me if I'm wrong, or Teresa Cromati. She was also on Random Acts of Flyness, which was on HBO.
Oh.
She's super cool. She makes these most gorgeous, like, psychedelic but weird figural paintings that are ginormous and fluid and abstracted and all of the things. And I've just kind of become obsessed with people who also embody their art. Like, she looks like her paintings. And
wow.
I love that. She, yeah, and her work on Random Acts of Flyness really inspired me in a way to think beyond 2D surfaces.
Okay.
To think into
Yes.
other dimensions.
Yes.
And then there's another artist, Kluvi. I don't know her first name, but she kind of does riffs on religious paintings about like exorcism and about leaving your body and divinity, but paints dark characters, paints black people in a way with a gentleness that we rarely see.
Right.
They're more than just a body. They're a fully functioning human.
I definitely want to check out her work.
Yes. I'm going to see what her Instagram handle is. Yeah. Nautiline Kluvi Pierre.
Okay.
Based in New York. Very wonderful. Lots of angel imagery, which is interesting because I never thought that that was like my thing. I was never like, I used to really loathe like Renaissance art classes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then there's a lot of black artists taking that and being like, nah, we're going to do something else.
Right.
Who else am I inspired by or watching or looking at? Guadalupe Rosales is an archivist and photographer. She works predominantly in Los Angeles, archiving photos of Latinx and Chicanx party culture in the 90s, which to me is super cool. They run an Instagram called Veteranas and Rucas, and it's all like these most gorgeous pictures of people at raves in LA or people at kickbacks or at the swap meet or photos that you got taken at JCPenney's with your loved one. You know, it's that. And she just won a Gordon Parks Foundation award or funding, correct me if I'm wrong. And yeah, Guadalupe is doing really amazing stuff. And then more recently, I've started to get really excited about textile art, thinking about how useful, and I'm using air quotes, but you can't see them. Useful objects are also beautiful objects. Thinking about quilts and thinking about, you know, knitted material and all that good stuff. So researching a lot of where that comes from and how black people, particularly in the Americas, have a really healthy history with modern and contemporary textile art, but it's just considered not art because it's useful. So
interesting.
Yeah, there's a huge like push and pull happening there, and I'm like, nah, that should be hung on walls and used. Why can't we do both?
Right.
So yeah, thinking a lot about textiles and fabric.
Okay. A couple of the artists you just mentioned, you know, I'm imagining that they have a huge presence on Instagram, whether it's following at least as a way to display their work. I'm going to beat a dead horse.
Okay.
Well, for you guys, it's new listeners. I mean, it's new information from my mouth, but it's something I've been saying to artists of many different disciplines since we've been on Instagram. Please, 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 please make sure your Instagram is in private. If you're an artist of a friend of mine, a couple friends of mine, graphic designers, like unbelievably talented. And I'm like, oh yeah, you got to check them out. And the page is private. I'm just like, okay.
I know.
But back to what we're talking about. Some of the artists you name, again, they're on Instagram. How much of an impact would you say Instagram has had on checking out these artists and giving them visibility? Not, of course, to the level of, you know, being in a museum or you know, having a gallery in a notable spot. But how much is that, you know, and how have you seen Instagram's curated in a way mm-hmm. that are just as good as you, you know, mm-hmm. walking through a gallery?
Oh, and I almost think this might be an aside. I almost think Instagram efforts are sometimes better than what curators are doing
really?
In galleries or museums. I do. I think they're, and I also sometimes think it's worse. But Instagram, for better or for worse, is the vehicle through which artists seek recognition. And I think it also, for me, like I said, I grew up on the internet. So when I was in these college art history classes, I knew there was something that people, that my predominantly white professors trained in a classic art history, weren't showing me.
Hmm.
So the internet allowed me to do the deep dive.
When you said they weren't showing you this stuff, was it just because it wasn't part of the curriculum? They didn't see, you know, historically, just they have an absence to that?
Yeah. I also, it's two things. I think, one, they're not tapped in.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of folks in art history who aren't willing to look beyond the textbook, who aren't willing to look beyond who their favorite galleries are representing or who the big name museums are showing. And two, I think, I mean, speaking candidly, we have systemically excluded and continue to systemically exclude like artists of color, black and brown artists, disabled artists, queer artists, all the artists that we consider to be, and air quotes, non-normative artists mm-hmm. who aren't white, cis, heterosexual individuals who we understand from a white supremacist ideological standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's one, these individuals don't know, and two, they're taught to teach in a way that excludes these artists. So it's just, it's become almost robotic. And I used to get in a lot of trouble for being like, but what about, how about we talk about, can we spend more time on and pushing?
Really?
Yeah, I had there were a few students who we kind of decided to band together to, in our senior seminar, to accurately inject black femme and women artists into our last class because they weren't being covered. And I see that as a huge deficit. And we learned how to do that from the internet.
What was the reaction? What was the reaction to that?
I think it was a mixed bag because I think we're also not taught how to speak about blackness. Black people are in some ways, but right. also non-black individuals have a hard time even saying the word black. You know, and have a hard time saying, like, we do a dance. There's a dance that happens.
Right.
And I think the reaction was a mixed bag. And some of the individuals in that department were confused as to why we were adamant about, if we're talking about black feminist theory, let's read black feminist theorists. Instead of reading a white men talk about black
right,
feminist theory
right.
and then apply that to black art, air quotes. And like, yeah, I think people were upset by it. And I also want to say that like, this work I learned from other people. This is not me reinventing the wheel. And a lot of the time, the people who initiate this work in the creative world get zero credit. Like I said, the people who have taught me the most on the internet are also obscured from fame, and we don't give them credit, and we don't cite our sources, and that's a huge problem.
Oh, yeah.
Because as a light-skinned black person, in a lot of ways, people want to hear it from me, but issues with colorism tie into access to information and how we receive art and how we receive creativity. So I have immense amount of privilege in being able to be in, one, a college class, and two, be like, wait, we are not reading Patricia Hill Collins. Like, slam my fist down. I do get a different reaction. So I don't want to go on air and not acknowledge that right. like there is a deficit in how Black individuals are treated when trying to disrupt those white supremacist cycles. People often, not all the time, but will sometimes give me the time of day because of how I look. Gotcha. So a lot of people that I learned from would not get the same energy, and it's my duty to acknowledge that.
When you first realized that, what was that situation like as far as people creating space for you based on your complexion? Was that something that happened within academia or before that?
Before that. Luckily, my father was speaking to me about colorism from a very young age. Hmm. And I think it wasn't something that could be avoided, in the sense that my sister and I don't look like a lot of the rest of our Black family.
Okay.
And my parents weren't going to do the BS of like privileging us because we look a certain way. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Right.
Unconsciously, subconsciously, we are taught to prioritize light skin, closer to white bodies, individuals, behaviors, and castigate dark people. That is the way that this country is built, and it seeps into even familial everything. Mm-hmm. So it started with me before college, but then I think, again, sorry to go back to the internet, I started exploring Blackness in a different way and understanding that while I am received as a Black person in the world, people don't see me as white. Right. I'm not white passing, but I do have a different relationship to oppression.
Okay.
I do.
Yeah.
It, like, blatantly, and it's not saying that light-skinned people aren't oppressed, because we are, as Black people, that is our history.
But it's different.
But it's different. And I have no issue saying that, and it's the duty of light-skinned folks and mixed folks to acknowledge and take care of and put ourselves more on the line for individuals who are incessantly discriminated against and incessantly oppressed in a way that we are not. And again, that's not negating light-skinned people's Blackness, but we gotta progress in this conversation.
Right.
And I think in the art world, we're starting to get to that conversation too, which I'm excited about. I'm like, finally, let's talk about this.
That's dope.
That's dope.
I was definitely gonna ask you, you know, how did that, you know, affect some of the conversations you've had to have on behalf of, you know, African-American artists?
Yeah. I think it's affected it in all the ways, in the fact that people receive information from me differently.
Yeah.
In the fact that while I'm still seen as a Black person, people will prioritize light-skinned people in academic circles, in institutional ways that is really insidious and really not that different to how it operated during slavery.
Right.
It's not any different in a lot of ways.
It is what it is, and we have to own it. And I think finding smart ways to navigate it.
Totally.
You know, it's going to be the key. So let me ask you this. What suggestions would you have for someone who was listening right now? And, you know, you're starting to peel back the curiosity for them to start looking and studying Black art. I follow Swizz Beatz on Instagram.
So do I.
Love Swizz. And I think I want to say maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, I started noticing him highlighting Black artists. And then he formed the Dean Collection, and I started following that account. And his dedication to exposing Black artists led me down the path of understanding he himself used to, well, he was he's always been creating. I didn't know he was a visual artist for a long time. And he actually stepped back into it recently. So, you know, he's collecting everything from Cause to everybody. I think Jeff Koons. Like I said, I follow that account.
Mm-hmm.
I started following Hank.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Willis Thomas. And it was interesting, just scrolling the Dean Collection, I came across one of Hank Willis Thomas's pieces on the Dean Collection. Strike. He has that up there. So Instagram is accessible to everyone. What are some of the people you would suggest outside of the artists that you named earlier?
Sure.
Some of the accounts or, you know, collections you would suggest, hey, check these out.
Starting, I know Tumblr is antiquated. We don't use it no more. But Kimberly Drew, who's the former social media curator of the Met.
Oh, okay.
Shout out Kimberly Drew. She started a Tumblr when she was an undergrad called Black Contemporary Art. It is... it's exhaustive.
Does that work?
It's not updated very often anymore, okay. But I would say start there. It's nice because it's detached from the commentary of Instagram. It's detached from the likes. It's detached from some of the things that nudge us in certain directions. You can literally look at it as a whole page and just start clicking. Right. And it'll take you down this kind of like really wonderful rabbit hole. That's a really good place to start. Okay. And I would also say that Instagram, I think it's called Artsy in Black. It's an archivist who just literally will go through these like rampages of posting art. And art including stills from rap videos. Art including...
That is awesome.
Sections from silent films that Black individuals were involved in, including advertisement, including fashion, which I think is really exciting.
Yeah.
There's also a million Black archive Instagrams, like so many of them that consider culture an art object in and of itself.
So explain that, Black archive.
So in the sense that it is an individual or individuals or a team running an Instagram that is committed to documenting past, present, and future images of Black life.
Okay.
In the sense that they could post something about an exhibition from the 90s, but they could also repost someone's family photo. So again, it kind of dances that line between the personal, the curatorial, the art historical. The internet is your friend, and I know it's daunting, like it feels endless.
It can be.
But I would say, yeah, following people like Kimberly Drew. Her at name is at Museum Mammy. She interviewed Swizz Beatz recently and Dapper Dan, and it's a really good intersection of like culture and music and fashion and food and arenas of life that we sometimes don't consider to be artistic. Mm-hmm. And she is a queer woman, so she can't avoid the political aspects of it as well. None of us can.
Yeah.
It is a privilege to not politicize our engagement with art. I'm trying to think of who else. Ideal Black female.
How would you describe what she does?
Well, her name is Mandy Harris Williams.
Okay.
She is an educator who talks about browning up your feed, hashtag brown up your feed. And honestly, she's taught me so much. She is one of the individuals who I'd like to give credit to for initiating a new wave of thinking for me. I saw her speak at Yale Union last year, and she was talking about how algorithms encourage us to look at white art, white bodies, white influencers, white vacations, white food, whatever that means.
Wow.
And how algorithms are working against us as Black people, and again favoring more, and I do air quotes, palatable Black people. So like we make exception these apps, and she knows way more
Right.
She knows way more about this than I do. Mm-hmm. But apps are changing what we look at. and discouraging us from engaging in blackness. So doing hashtag brown up your feed is an act of visibility. And she, she has PowerPoint. She has a Patreon that you can donate to. She has GoFundMes. She's really doing the work. If you can invite her to come speak at something, please do, because that girl, about that.
Okay.
Yeah, her name's Mandy Harris Williams, but goes by Ideal Black Female, and talks a lot about algorithmic racism, which I didn't even know. I mean.
Yeah, my eyes are just, they're huge. they're saucers. What?
Yeah, she talks about how often, like, influencer culture, which has everything to do with contemporary art, and if you can fight me about it if you want to, but influencer culture not only influences the contemporary art world, but influences us to look at skinny bodies. And
yes, it does.
Influences us to look at light skin, white passing, and white bodies. Encourages us to look at facial features that do not come from an African lineage, and prioritize that through likes, prioritize that through comments, and then buying product, and how that's driving a market of anti-blackness. She is so smart. I probably did the worst paraphrasing of that because she's doing it. But that is a person, and she posts art too, because it's not separate. She's worked in museums. I saw her at a gallery. She makes the most fire PowerPoints, which is crazy, which is like, I never thought I'd be like, oh, I love this PowerPoint. I love that PowerPoint.
She makes fire PowerPoint. Yes. That is part of the art that she's
No, PowerPoints
us.
As contemporary art. Again, fight me about it. Just kidding.
That is dope. Yeah. Oh, man. Wow. Okay.
Sheesh. Ooh,
yeah.
You asked me and I answered.
Yes, yes, and I'm definitely going to follow her.
Yes,
brown
please.
Up your feed. I took notes. Everyone, brown up your feed.
Hashtag brown up your feed. Do that,
because you're right. The algorithm. It's funny because I'll find myself coming across artists that I know I'm following. And someone else will send me a screenshot and be like, yeah, did you see such and such post this? And I'm like, I follow this person. Why am I not seeing this?
Absolutely.
The algorithm is, we all complained about it when it first happened. We were like, we don't like this. I just want to see my photos of the people I'm following in the order they posted this algorithm. But I mean, after a while, you know, we just go along. And once the algorithm is in place, we don't know what they're tweaking. We don't know the changes that are being made monthly. We don't know the purpose of all the programming.
Or how it's influenced by what we look at on other sites.
Exactly.
How we're being tracked by ads through purchases. Mm-hmm. How we're being geo-tracked. Like, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's real.
Skynet is real.
I mean, in a lot of ways, like, turn off that location on your phone.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, think about it. From Uber any of the...
And how all these apps have now cross-platform interfacing aspects. So, like, how Uber connects to Facebook, how Cash App and Venmo connect to Instagram, how Instagram connects to da-da-da. And then YouTube puts ads for the shoes that you looked at 8 months ago.
Right.
And, like, who's wearing those shoes?
Right.
How much does those shoes cost? Who made those shoes? All those things. It's, like... so interconnected, and to consider the art world as separate from that is really interesting, because now galleries are using Instagram algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
The art world is responding to an increasingly social media world that is using racist tactics for algorithms. So what does that mean for galleries and museums? Jeez. It's a question. I got no answers, but I think about it.
Yeah.
I really do, because we can't, like we said, Instagram is the platform through which a lot of artists support themselves financially.
Right.
Socially.
Right.
Social capital. All those things. So I think it's definitely a conversation to be had. And yeah.
Okay. So we have...
Sheesh.
We have an event coming up.
Yes, we do.
I want to talk about Hank.
Let's talk about Hank.
Let's talk about Hank. The catalog.
Ah.
that you blessed us with.
I'm glad you liked it.
So here's the thing. When we had our initial meeting and you put the catalog on the table, I tried not to be distracted. It's tough. Then opened it up and started going through it, and it was like, oh my, yo, this is ill. This flip is crazy. So much of the imagery was very familiar.
Yeah.
And the flips he was taking on was just like, oh, it was just like punches to the gut one after the other.
It's heavy.
Yes. Very it's heavy.
Take breaks. Very heavy. While looking at it.
Got the catalog at home, started going through it. I had to take breaks.
Oh yes. So do I.
I had to take breaks. I'd hit a couple pages, close the book, set it across the room from me.
Go for a walk.
And just be like, okay.
It's heavy.
Tell us about Hank Willis Thomas.
Okay. Well, let me do my little Portland Art Museum plug.
Let's do it.
So coming in October, opening October 12th, closing January 12th, the Portland Art Museum is doing the first survey, large-scale survey, of a contemporary black artist named Hank Willis Thomas. He's a photographer, an archivist. He is a sculptor. He makes textile art. He makes video art. He probably does it if you ask him. And he thinks a lot about advertising and thinks a lot about image circulation. And it's a show curated by Julia Dillon and Sarah Kujewski, both curators at the Portland Art Museum. And Hank is an artist who makes work that confronts a lot of things, but in a lot of ways confronts consumption and confronts how cycles of images affect our political lives and how histories are obscured and changed and what liberation could maybe look like, maybe. And from the short amount of time that I've spent with him, it's a lot of research. So these very beautiful and challenging pieces of art and objects that he makes, the research that goes into them is immense. And I think that's what's really exciting about them, because he shows you the research.
Yeah.
He's not pulling the wool over your eyes, and it doesn't feel easy. And that to me is what's really exciting. His mother is Deborah Willis, who is an art historian and archivist and photographer, and he comes from a long line of black artists who are foundational to a lot of what we're talking about right now. Hank is Hank. We're really excited to have him, and I'm particularly working on community partnerships and programming for that exhibition and how we take this kind of international, national artist and body of work and acknowledge that Portland's ready to have that conversation and has been having that conversation.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I mean when, like, acknowledging people who are already doing the work.
Right.
This isn't new. This isn't new, and maybe it's overdue.
Definitely overdue.
So,
how would you suggest preparing Black Portland for this?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I shy away from being prescriptive that all black folk will experience this in the same way. As sure. I mentioned earlier, I have a different relationship to some of these things. As someone who's like engulfed in the arts every waking second of every waking day, I'm like, yeah, this is what I do. So are a lot of us in other ways. Right. But I would say you already know a lot of the material.
Okay.
You already know a lot of the content. I would say in some ways, think about how you're already engaging in some of these themes. Maybe you're already having these conversations. What black artists in Portland are you supporting, knowing of, following on Instagram? Are you doing that? Some of us don't want to do that, and I think that's okay, too. Okay. I don't want to say that everybody needs to be engaging in contemporary art practice in any sort of way, because my job isn't to tell black people how to be black. That's no thank you.
Woo, flames.
I mean, that's not my job.
No, and, you're right.
That should never be my job. But I would love if black Portlanders just came to the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to make it as least prohibitive as possible for us to come to this exhibition and feel good and feel joy and feel rage and feel the full range of emotions, because it is that. It's 10,000 square feet of really intense work, and that's why the community partners team is occupying 250 of those square feet and creating a partner space. And the community is our partner as well. It's not just these official partners. It is Black Portland that we want to come sit in this space. I'm curating it to be like a living room. So come talk to me.
When you say you're making steps to make it as least prohibitive, what do those steps look like? What are some of the things in your mind that were like, oh, this is an absolute necessary item?
Yeah.
And this over here, we're definitely not doing, you guys. You've lost your mind. No. This is not how we need this to happen.
Yeah. So Hank thinks a lot about incarceration, mass incarceration. Right. So I'm advocating for all formerly incarcerated individuals, which is disproportionately Black individuals in the United States, to get into this show for free. So it is things of that nature. And while I understand that it's not always the dollar amount that stops people from coming, it's not always the dollar amount that stops people from staying. But in a lot of ways, if we can break down those financial and monetary barriers, mm-hmm. that is huge to me. So activating our $5 Fridays, activating Family Sundays with this programming in a way that sees it for everyone.
Right.
I don't want this exhibition to become an experience for white people where it's like, oh, white people get to go see Black pain as this artistic endeavor. And I worry about that. Speaking candidly, that is something that I and a lot of other Black people who work at the museum and work at museums, mm-hmm. like, this is not a Portland issue. This is a museum issue. The displaying of pain, this kind of like trauma porn, yeah. is difficult. And I'm still working through how we, there's no such thing as a 100% safe space.
No.
But how do I create a safer space, or how do I become a point person that can facilitate aspects of safety in a place like Portland? So we're thinking a lot about those things, and thinking a lot about how in programming we are hiring Black creatives.
Okay.
That's it. Period. Like, period.
Right.
City Girls, shout out. But what was I going to say? It is hiring Black photographers to photograph these events. It is making sure Black press is at our press previews.
Okay.
It is partnering with Black folks doing the work. It is hiring Black teaching artists to work with children, regardless of the demographic of those children.
Right.
And then also continuing this work. It doesn't stop at an exhibition about Blackness. It continues. The museum has a duty to not make this project base and to take the work that we're doing and extend it.
Mm-hmm.
So relying on those resources for future exhibitions and proving to Black Portland that we will continue to do that. And I am understanding of distrust, and I am understanding of apprehension.
Okay.
And I welcome that conversation, and I'm... Email me, text me, DM me, pull up on me.
Pull up.
We can talk about it. But yeah, trying to secure some of those like more securable things.
Yeah.
Like the things that I can help control.
Right.
And I can help funnel money into the community. And I can help support events and programming that have nothing to do with Hank. But those people maybe will come see Hank, and I believe in what they're doing. We'll do that.
Hmm.
That means a lot to me.
Yeah, that's a huge part. I think that's something that we don't really take into consideration when, you know, that there's a eagerness and desire just to create Black spaces.
Totally.
Period. We're looking for places where we can feel safe
totally.
Expressing any range of emotions. When you spoke about what it felt like for white people to kind of fetishize or experience Black pain, the first thing that came to my mind was going to the movies here in Portland.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh.
And when you're watching certain films, there are moments when everyone else is laughing and you're not. And it's like, this wasn't funny.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's moments when you're laughing and no one else is getting it because
you're like, this is hilarious. Culture.
This is, you know, those Hey Auntie moments, like, you know, that was for us. But yeah, I remember the first time experiencing that. We saw Moonlight here in Portland.
So did I.
Yeah. And there were scenes that were just like, what's going on around me? And then again, like you mentioned, it happened again in Get Out. It happened again in Us. Shout out to Jordan Peele just doing this thing out here.
Doing the thing.
Being very purposeful. Because you can't really say, and not that there's a complete desire to say only black people, whatever the function is.
Totally.
But even if there's a... like a little waiver or disclaimer on the wall on your way in. Just, guys, please, everyone, please acknowledge what's happening here.
Yeah.
Acknowledge what people may be experiencing.
What's your role in this?
Yeah. There it is.
What is your role in this actualizing in real life in Portland, Oregon, even though you think it's some liberal safe haven? It is for you.
Huh.
But, like, I really seek to prioritize, like, black, brown, and indigenous people sitting up front. At our lectures. You like when we have black speakers, white people cannot fill the front rows just because they got tickets maybe first.
Right.
That is not, that doesn't behoove anyone. Right. That doesn't change anything.
Right.
But like, space is a huge, it's something I think about a lot and it's in some ways uncontrollable. And I don't know if I want to control every aspect. But I want to make sure that we're prioritizing people experiencing the work in whatever way they see fit.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's, I don't like this, then that's fine. Express that.
Right.
That's where the partners in residence, like this community space that we will be programming and getting all going. I would love to hear, why don't you like this?
You know?
Instead of being like, oh, you don't understand it. No, you understand it. Tell me why you don't like it. Right. Or tell me, maybe it isn't as cut and dry as I don't like it. It's, I have an issue with this aspect. Or I didn't
feel
a certain way. And it's not my job to be anybody's translator or anybody's therapist or anything. I'm just here to receive that and hopefully provide a space where you feel like you're heard.
Mm.
Whether that's through interviews, whether that's through a curation of something, whether that's through having that person come back and speak about that, debriefing. It's about providing those opportunities for people to be heard beyond collecting data.
Right.
If I have anything to do with it, black people will not become data in this exhibition, but will become an integral part of community curation, radical community curation.
In a city like this, it's very important that we see us.
Yes.
It's very important. Representation is at the top of the list for me because it sparks that desire to replicate the greatness you're seeing in front of you.
Totally.
It really does. So for a child to be able to see a black artist in a space like the Portland Art Museum.
Yes.
It's like, so this kind of lends, you know, some credibility to what I'm doing at home.
Absolutely.
You know, whether they're getting that positive reinforcement at home or in school, they're seeing it like, I can do this. I can be this.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. This was an amazing discussion.
Yay.
For anyone that wants to get some more information on the upcoming exhibit, what would you recommend they do?
I would go to the Portland Art Museum website. Mm-hmm. I would also go to the Portland Art Museum Instagram. And
hello.
We're on all the social medias. Okay. And also, I will be getting the information out through other means. So let's keep our ears open and eyes peeled. I think I said that right. Mm-hmm. About all the info. And hopefully we can start a discussion. But portlandartmuseum.org, or is it .com? I should probably
probably both.
We got both.
Yeah.
Go there. Read about it. Go to Hank's Instagram. He's at Hank Willis Thomas. Mm-hmm. He's already talking about it. And he's just a fun person to follow. He is active. Yeah. Do those things. Find me. you know, I'm out here. We can talk about it.
Out here.
Out here. Thank you so much. This was such a good conversation.
Oh, it was great. Thank you guys for listening.
Awesome.
All right, now stay tuned, guys. Stay tuned. We have more excellent programming coming up next.